Part 2. When bankers get together for dinner, they discuss art. When artists get together for dinner, they discuss money. Oscar Wilde. Chapter 6. A View into the Outside World. To see far is one thing. Going there is another. Brancusi. To the artist, all problems of art appear uniquely personal. Well, that's understandable enough, given that not many other activities routinely call one's basic self-worth into question. But those really personal problems all relate to the making of the art. Once the art has been made, an entirely new set of problems arise, problems that require the artist to engage the outside world. Call them ordinary problems. Ordinary problems. Ordinary problems are not, however, trivial problems. Among other things, they consume the larger part of almost every artist's time. One well-known painter, after several months of careful record-keeping, reached the discouraging conclusion that even at best, he could free up only 6 or 7 days a month for actually painting, while the remaining 20-odd days inevitably went to gallery business, studio cleaning, UPS runs, and the like. Moral, there's one hell of a lot more to art than just making it. In many cases, the art you make today will reach its audience tomorrow only because of a vast societal network geared to arts education, funding, criticism, publication, exhibition, and performance. In many other cases, unfortunately, your art will only reach the world in spite of this network. Many attempts to introduce art to the larger world simply give evidence of the uneasy fit in our society between economics and beliefs. In many quarters, art is viewed as dangerous, unnecessary, elitist, expensive, and dependent on the patronage of effete East Coast liberals for its survival. Artists themselves fare little better, being wildly portrayed as subversive weirdos who not only enjoy living in sin, but are probably doing it off your tax dollars as well. Having said that, the authors would like to employ this sentence to proclaim a self-imposed moratorium on cynicism in their future discussions, regardless of how much the bastards deserve it. Thank you. The management. In any case, there's nothing obscure about either the cause or the effect of these attitudes. Some art, by its very nature, is subversive. By leading the viewer to experience the world through the very different sensibilities of the artist, a good work of art inevitably calls the viewer's own belief system into question. Is this threatening? Is the Pope Catholic? The more effective the art, the more likely the viewer's first reaction will be anger and denial, followed immediately by a search for someone to blame. And in that department, the artist is always the most likely candidate. We have, after all, a time-honored tradition of killing the messenger who delivers the bad news. One of the more celebrated examples of mowing down the messenger, and everyone else in sight, involved Robert Mapplethorpe, a photographer who made a set of images overtly romanticizing homosexuality. As it turned out, threats didn't mean a lot to Mapplethorpe, who was already terminally ill as he readied his body of work for exhibit. Instead, pressure points were found in the supporting arts network, especially the National Endowment for the Arts. Subtlety was not in great abundance here. The NEA was simply threatened with a cutoff of funding if it lent support to artists or museums that made or exhibited work that offended community standards. There were counter-protests, of course, and in the end, Mapplethorpe's work was exhibited, but the message to the arts community was clear. Stray too far from the innocuous, and the axe would fall. Call it selective censorship. Freedom of expression was guaranteed unless it was expressed in a work of art. The most amazing aspect of this American morality play was not that the government would place self-interest above principle when it felt threatened, but that no one foresaw this coming from miles down the road. Reminder from history, the American Revolution was not financed with matching grants from the crown. Common ground. It goes without saying that censorship is debilitating to the artist. It's a little less obvious, at least to the artists, that censorship is an entirely natural state of affairs. Nature places a simple constraint on those who leave their flock to go their own way. They get eaten. In society, it's a bit more complicated. Nonetheless, the abomination stands. Avoiding the unknown has considerable survival value. Society, nature, and art making tend to produce guarded creatures. The dilemma here is that for the artist, contact with subject and materials must always remain unguarded. In making art, you court the unknown, and with it, the paranoia of those who fear what change might bring. But while fear of attracting the wrath of some southern senator may cast a shadow on your freedom of expression, often the more vexing problem is catching anyone's attention in the first place. After all, most people see no reason to question their own beliefs, much less solicit yours. And why should they? Artistically and otherwise, the world we come into has already been observed and defined by others. Thoroughly, redundantly, comprehensively, and usually quite appropriately. The human race has spent several millennia developing a huge and robust set of observations about the world, in forms as varied as language, art, and religion. Those observations, in turn, have withstood many, enormously many, tests. We stand heir to an unstatably large set of meanings. Most of what we inherit is so clearly correct, it goes unseen. It fits the world seamlessly. It is the world. But despite its richness and variability, the well-defined world we inherit doesn't quite fit each one of us individually. Most of us spend our time in other people's worlds, working at predetermined jobs, relaxing to pre-packaged entertainment. And no matter how benign this ready-made world may be, there will always be time when something is missing or doesn't quite ring true. And so you make your place in the world by making part of it, by contributing some new part to the set. And surely, one of the more astonishing rewards of art making comes when people make time to visit the world you have created. Some, indeed, may even purchase a piece of your world to carry back and adopt as their own. Each new piece of your art enlarges our reality. The world is not yet done. Art issues. It seems harmless enough to observe here that having an MFA, or even a knowledge of modern art, should hardly be a prerequisite to making art. After all, art appeared long before art departments, long before anyone began classifying or collecting artists' work. Nonetheless, most artists today do have formal training in art, a familiarity with the current art world trends, and at least some dependence on galleries or academia for their livelihood. This is understandable, if not exactly healthy, given that each link in the arts network has a vested interest in defining its own role as fundamental and necessary. One of the ordinary problems artists face is finding a way to make peace with the arts network and the issues it holds dear. Not necessarily joining it, mind you, just making peace with it. At least you need to if you want assurance your work will be shown, published, or performed in any reasonable length of time. If the need to get shown is strong enough, this is not a problem. But the unease many artists feel today betrays a lack of fit between the work of their heart and the emotionally remote concerns of curators, publishers, and promoters. It's hard to overstate the magnitude of this problem. Finding your place in the art world is no easy matter, if indeed there is a place for you at all. In fact, one of the few sure things about the contemporary art scene is that someone besides you is deciding which art and which artists belong in it. It's been a tough century for modesty, craftsmanship, and tenderness. Competition. There's no denying competition. It's hardwired into us. It's chemical. Good athletes bank on that surge of energy that arises in the instant of knowing they can overtake the runner just ahead. Good artists thrive on exhibit and publication deadlines, on working 20 hours straight, to see the pots are glazed and fired just so, on making their next work better than their last. The urge to compete provides a source of raw energy, and for that purpose alone, it can be exceptionally useful. In a healthy artistic environment, that energy is directed inward to fulfill one's own potential. In a healthy artistic environment, artists are not in competition with each other. Unfortunately, healthy artistic environments are about as common as unicorns. We live in a society that encourages competition at demonstrably vicious levels and sets a hard and accountable yardstick for judging who wins. It's easier to rate artists in terms of the recognition they've received, which is easily compared, than in terms of the pieces they've made, which may be as different as apples and waltzes. And when that happens, competition centers not on making work, but on collecting the symbols of acceptance and approval of that work. NEA grants, a show at Galerie du Jour, a celebrity profile in The New Yorker, and the like. Taken to extremes, such competition slides into needless and often self-destructive comparison with the fortunes of others. W.C. Fields became enraged at the mere mention of Charlie Chaplin's name. Milton suffered lifelong depression from ongoing self-comparison with Shakespeare. Salieri went a bit more insane each time he compared his music to Mozart's. And who among us would welcome that comparison? Fear that you're not getting your fair share of recognition leads to anger and bitterness. Fear that you're not as good as a fellow artist leads to depression. Admittedly, few of us are above feeling a momentary stab of pain when someone else wins the fellowship we sought, or a secret rush of triumph when we scoop up that same prize. Kingsley Amis allowed that when he'd start writing a new novel. Part of his motive was, I'm going to show them this time. But occasionally, competitive grousing is a healthy step removed from equating success with standing atop the bodies of your peers. If nothing else, it's hard to claim victory when your imagined competitors may be entirely unaware of your existence. After all, some may have already been dead for a century. Quite plausibly, they don't win, while you, sooner or later, will lose. In some form of comparison, defeat is all but inevitable. But regardless of the yardstick used, all competitors share one telling characteristic. They know where they rank in the pack. Avid competitors check their ranking constantly. Obsessive competitors simply equate rank with self, a chancy gambit, but one that works, when it does work, by tapping a source of energy that makes them work harder at their art, and almost always makes them good careerists. When sense of self depends so directly upon the ranking bestowed by the outside world, motivation to produce work that brings high ratings is extreme. In not knowing how to tell yourself that your work is okay, you may be driven to the top of the heap in trying to get the rest of the world to tell you. In theory, this is a perfectly valid approach. The tricky part is finding the right yardstick for measuring your accomplishments. What makes competition in the arts a slippery issue is simply that there's rarely any consensus about what your best work is. Moreover, what's important about each new piece is not whether it is better or worse than your previous efforts, but the ways in which it is similar or different. The meaningful comparison between two Bach fugues is not how they rank, but how they work. When things go really well in your art making, all the pieces you make have a life to them, regardless of how they stack up as personal favorites. After all, they're all your babies. It can even be argued that you have an obligation to explore the possible variations, given that a single artistic question can yield many right answers. Productive times encourage you to build an extended body of work, one where all the pieces, even the flawed sketches that will never see the gallery wall, have a chance to play. In healthy times, you rarely pause to distinguish between internal drive, sense of craft, the pressure of a deadline, or the charm of a new idea, They all serve as sources of energy in the pieces you make. Navigating the system. Artists, it turns out, are a crafty lot and surprisingly adept at getting the system to foot the bill for letting them do exactly what they wanted to do anyway. Michelangelo painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel on commission from the church. Ansel Adams photographed Moonrise, Hernandez, on assignment for the Department of the Interior. Eames Furniture and Avedon Fashion spreads prove that art can prevail even at the extremes of commerce and fluff. Indeed, a disconcertingly strong argument can be made for the proposition that many artworks, especially large-scale efforts like the Parthenon or the Vietnam War Memorial, have had a buyer in place before the artwork was begun. The problem is to keep such command performances from tainting the work that follows, since commissioned art has a way of sliding slowly and imperceptibly into commercial trade. This is especially troublesome for art forms that have a widespread and higher-paying commercial applications. The challenge in such circumstances is to convince the patron that you alone know the right way to make this piece. For some artists, it's a trade-off, or perhaps a standoff. At Christmas time, ballet companies, even the major players, offer an inordinate number of performances of The Nutcracker, that being the only ballet that generates enough ticket sales to pull them through the rest of the season. Likewise, printmakers, without altering the content of their work, learn soon enough which images will likely justify the cost of running a large edition. For many other artists, however, the arts network proves an unmitigated disaster. Sometimes it's just that the freewheeling thought patterns that led to art making don't lead as gracefully to tidy record keeping. More often, though, the same artists who diligently follow a self-imposed discipline, like writing in iambic pentameter or composing for solo piano, prove singularly ill-equipped to handle constraints imposed by others. Edward Weston's well-meaning friends once convinced a coffee company to offer that artist a commission to make still-life photographs they could use in their magazine ads. About the only requirement was that the company's product appear somewhere in the arrangement. Nonetheless, Weston, whose facility with photographing small objects as art is legendary, was driven to complete distraction by the pressure of having to make one of those small objects a coffee can. Ideally, at least from the artist's viewpoint, the arts network is there to handle all those details not central to the art-making process. This is a healthy attitude to nurture, since some art forms, like cinema and literature, could never make the leap from idea to reality without a sizable investment from the outside anyway. Writers routinely mail out manuscripts and leave virtually all that follows, proofreading, design, printing, distribution and promotion, in the publisher's hands. Some artists even make the interface a prominent part of their work. Christo's various wrappings are a form of performance art experienced directly by relatively few people, but the record of the performance has become its own art piece, exhibited in museums complete with maps, working drawings, correspondence with zoning boards, logistical plans, and so on. If all this evidence of the reach of today's art network still fails to impress you, consider the sobering corollary. Once you're dead, all your art is handled by this network. But if the artist stands as an endangered species in the face of contemporary economics and marketing, we are faced with a perplexing question. Why does the myth of the individual artist, the loner following his or her own heart, arise so predictably with each new generation? One possible answer is suggested by looking at the things that have made art worth doing in the past. Work that was driven by issues arising from the relationship between the artist and the work, or the artist and the materials, or the artist and the subject matter, rings true. Such work, regardless of whether it fits with then-contemporary attitudes, seems to continue to make sense over time. A second answer, more tentative, taps into the deep wellsprings of art, utility and ritual. In very early times, these basic needs proved the cultural niche for art, while self-expression, even if unrecognized as such, served to integrate personal experience and skill with those larger goals. But ritual, which took form as painted bison on the cave wall and found its high flowering in the time of the great religions, had receded into secular fad and decoration. And utility, in whose service the early artist gave form to every object from obsidian arrowhead to fired clay pottery, has yielded to complexity and mass production. In our time, the cultural niche for art remains unfulfilled, while self-expression has become an end in itself. This may not be the healthiest of situations, but then again, no one said we're living in the healthiest of times either. End of chapter.